And this authenticity we gain by continually engaging in a struggle against commoditization, against imperialism of our everyday life, and world imperialism. And we do see that we are engaged in a struggle against our own alienation inside of us, from ourselves and others, those who are not our oppressors or their accomplices. So I want to just read one poem, or maybe two, one short poem and one longer poem to finish what I have to say. This poem is called Terror, and it is again about the kind of ascriptive images and terror in which people live. It is a nice day, says someone to me in the elevator. I say nothing. It is not nice to me since I spend the morning reading the Globe, watching them tie the knot tighter around the neck of Africa. The noose they put around the neck of the first black man has expanded through the centuries taking in the world. When they land paratroopers in Zaire, preside and peacemake in Rhodesia, offer love on the points of a bayonet, I'm choked in my apartment in this peaceful city with its atmosphere of hospital, prison, and department store. I go out into the street, silent, stand at the corner, stalled by the red finger of law and order. People stand or walk with their faces swathed in transparent plastic. I catch the eye of a black woman. We recognize each other. The plastic begins to crack, but order tells us to walk, and we go our separate ways. I think of my daughter. I grow afraid. I see designs against her deep set into their concrete structures or embossed into their Education Act. The blue of the sky, the gold of the sun, become an Aryan-eyed blonde, and her spiked heels dig into my bowels. Fear lurks in the trees and gives the leaves their sharp precision. I sit in the Queen's Park in the shadow of King George V. I am under his horse's hooves. I realize what once Karl Marx meant by being subject to the violence of things, a violence and oppression so successfully realized that it has no separate life. It lives, no longer in itself contained like a cop's dog tied to a leash, but in us, multiplied by our million cells in our retina, eardrums, nostrils, or goose flesh of the skin, lives this terror, at once an effect and cause. This poem, the last thing I will read, was written after an experience of having been spat upon on the street. And it's called Paki, Go Home, which is what they said while they spat out of a car's window. There were two women and three young men in the car, and I was standing by the bus stop, and they leaned out, and one of them spat. It was pretty well aimed. 3 p.m., sunless, winter sleeping in the womb of the afternoon, wondering how to say this, to reason, to scream, or cry, or whisper, or write on the walls, reduced again, cut at the knees, hands chopped, eyes blinded, mouth stopped, voices lost. Fear, anger, contempt. Thin filaments of ice and fire wired the bodies, my own, of hers, of his, the young and the old. And a grenade exploded, and words run down like frothy white spit down her bent head, down the serene parting of her dark hair as she stands too visible from home to bus stop to home, raucous hyena laughter, Paki, go home. The moon covers her face, pockmarked and anxious in the withered fingers of the winter trees. The light of her sadness runs like tears down the concrete hills, tarmac rivers, and the gullies of the cities. The wind still carries that secret chuckle, the rustle of canes, as black, brown bodies flee into the night, blanched by the salt waters of the moon. Strange, dark fruits on tropical trees swing in the breeze gently. Now, then and again, we must organize. The woman wiping the slur spit from her face, the child standing at the edge of the playground, silent, stopped. The man twisted in despair, disabled at the city gates. Even the child in the womb must find a voice, sound in unison, organized, like a song, like a roar, like a prophecy that changes the world. To organize, to fight the slaver's dogs, to find the hand, the foot, the tongue, the body dismembered, organ by organ rejoined, organized, soul breathed in until she, he, the young, the old is whole, until the hand acts moved by the mind, and the walls, the prisons, the chains of lead or gold tear, crumble, wither into dust, and the dead bury the dead until yesterday's never return.
I'd like to take a short 10-minute break. Thank you very much, Imani and Kathleen.
Dale, who you've already met, some of you at least. She's a video artist, a writer, and has been a long-term worker at Interval House in Toronto, which is a transition house, and works with the Artists Union in Toronto as well.
Okay, I'm going to read a little something to start with. I'm also I'm going to circulate two things to you. That are kind of represented in slide form, but one is, but I wanted people, these were things which are actually meant to be handled, and I'd like them to be passed through the audience. One of them was an art piece, which I'll be talking about, that was at the Art Gallery of Ontario in 1974, and the other is an issue of Insight magazine that Joan Borsa had some slides from, and I also do too. And it's has a number of people's pieces in it, including the one on sexuality, the mock ad for condoms, condominiums, whatever. So I'm going to do that. Even the magazine I need to get back, which I'll tell you about why later. Okay, I'm going to open by reading something which two or three people here might have heard, or perhaps more. It was something that I wrote for the College Art Association Conference in February of 1984. I was on a panel called Power and Sex, or Power and Sex and Women and something else. Jeff Wall was on the panel, Leon Golub, Mary Kelly, Barbara Kruger, and it was chaired by Judith Berry. And it's what I wrote was a polemic. And with no illustrations. And what I'm doing is I'm going to read partially from that. It presents a sort of utopian whatever, or poses a question to women artists in particular. Then I'm going to show you some of my work, particularly very early work that I did, which doesn't at all live up to what I'm saying in here. So the contradictions abound there. But I wanted to talk about some of that. So this is this paper, which is from 1984. I would like to quote the opening paragraphs from the introduction to a book entitled The Powers of Desire. This passage is authored by Anne Snitow, Christine Stancell, and Sharon Thompson, who edited this collection of essays, mostly by women, on the politics of sexuality and the surrounding social constructions evident on examination. They say, quote, "Why write about sex? Sex is everywhere. Why add to the tawdry glut? What are the advantages and disadvantages to individuals, to social groups, of elaborating and developing sex as a central form of expression, one that defines identity and is seen as a primary source of energy and pleasure? In spite of its publicity, sex remains oddly taboo, particularly for women. The widespread exposure to sexual imagery and talk seems not to have made a dent in the embarrassment, the sexual shame that begins in childhood and which the entire culture endlessly recreates, keeps the sense of taboo alive even in a blitz of the sexually explicit. Perhaps taboo and shame are among the necessary products of capitalism. Certainly shame, guilt, and trauma can short-circuit the radical traditions that have named sex as creative and life-affirming, so that even the most progressive works on sex are often stilted, cautious, or imbued with the melancholy of sex. But however much either the morally righteous or the politically earnest call sex trivial, a self-indulgent luxury, or one more consumer item in the capitalist marketplace, the commercialization of sex has failed to render it a mere product. Perhaps, as novelist Jane Rule has observed, and they quote, "A body we know is designed to die will never be a simple plaything," end quote, end quote. Further to this passage, many would ask, why make art about sex, and particularly why, as a woman, make art about sex, which is what I wanted to speak about. The presence of explicitly sexual imagery within art practice is still not that common, even though there are many references to sexuality, and particularly there are critiques of the pornographic image, the definition of which is quite broad within these critiques, ranging from mass media advertising photos to the images of bound and gagged women and men which appear in skin magazines, sex films, and videotapes, etc. By sexually explicit imagery, I mean images of sexual acts which are not ambiguous, that are not metaphors for sex but are sex. So I would personally exclude from this category of explicit sexual imagery a picture or a film of a human tongue spreading apart the sections of an orange, for example, but include a similar image which featured a human tongue spreading apart a vulva. It's important to point out that I'm well aware that neither of these images is really sex. Both are representations of acts. I'm merely trying to define what I mean by explicit sexual imagery. By doing this, I realize that I omit all the many very developed discussions around the fetish object itself, all the many things which mobilize individual sexuality, the list of which would be long indeed. But for the moment, I want to consider the actual image of acts of sex engaged in by humans, singly, in pairs, groups, with whatever. And I wish to question why these images in particular have been colonized almost completely by the mass sex media for its own use, circulation, and sale. In other words, why are artists not producing more images which are explicitly sexual? A British video artist, Stuart Marshall, who is a gay artist and works within the gay movement as well as doing videotapes, in a discussion we had at just prior to this, when I presented this paper, he suggested a word which he called erotophobia. I began to try to define what that meant for me, fear of the erotic, particularly as it locates itself in the work of artists whose work is involved particularly in addressing social issues. Now, assuming that artists possess a no more generalized fear of fucking than the general population, what is the fear? I think that partly it must originate in artists' reading of their audience, both official audience, the galleries, critics, granting agencies, patrons, not that anybody has them anymore, as well as the off-the-street audience, which is the public made up of other artists, as well as individuals who have a special interest in some particular work, and finally members of the community at large who participate in cultural activities. The former audience, the official one, as all artists know, is quite subject to political pressures. These political pressures are regular routine within all democracies such as the one we live in. Here, elected or appointed officials speak out, always in the name of their unnamed constituents, against the exhibition, funding, display, etc., of some piece of transgressing art. And I'm not for a moment suggesting that this official outcry is always directed against the sexually explicit. Far from it. But artists know and are frequently reminded that sexually explicit work is part of the lexicon of the forbidden, along with calls to revolution, armed or otherwise, as are direct challenges to government, large corporations, etc. And the Varda Burstyn gave you an example yesterday, the display in the window that was busted by the police in Toronto certainly was not explicit sexually. And in Vancouver here, about a year and a half ago, some videotapes were canceled out of the Vancouver Art Gallery done by Paul, those tapes by Paul Wong. They were discussions about sexuality. So we're pretty far away from sexually explicit imagery. But I think from this, I wanted to indicate that that artists do understand that sexually explicit imagery can get you in trouble. There's no doubt about it. From the official audience. But what of the other part of art's audience, which I refer to as the off-the-street crowd, which is for most of us the more relevant part anyway, and certainly who we deal with more on a day-to-day basis? Is our erotophobia on their behalf justified? In this case, I would say no, because in exercising this, I think we travel the same track as do the official censors, whom we abhor when they speak against our work on behalf of the public. But obviously, none of us want to self-censor our own work. So how does this process happen? How do we begin to make conjectures about what their limits are, particularly around sexual imagery? For many of us, I think it begins with a sense of responsibility, with an overall thoughtfulness as to how to present our work. We go to great lengths to construct a videotape, a film, a photograph, so that our intentions will be evident, will reveal themselves to the audience. And more importantly, so that the work, even if it is critical of an existing situation, will go forward in some way, will become part of a larger discussion which is about social change in some particular area. I am addressing particular kinds of artists as opposed to people who have no interest in social change in terms of producing art. But when it comes to the possible inclusion of imagery which is sexually explicit, the same rigorous analysis often seems to fail us. It is as if the sexual shame which the editors of Powers of Desire refer to were the real operative force, and our powers of self-critique become hindrances rather than useful tools. And I think we frequently subject our thoughts about sexually explicit imagery to the same critique which we subject mass-produced pornography to. And this is definitely a problem. Because the conditions of production, the intention, and I fully believe the result of the display of our images are totally different. I'm not suggesting that our own images of explicit sex could go forward somehow in a blessed state of self-declared innocence, unencumbered by the various connotations, denotations, interpretations, and very genuine feelings of discomfort, dread, embarrassment, and sometimes horror, which are quite rightly read into mass-produced porn. What I am suggesting is that if we were to treat these images of sex with the same self-analysis and pre-thought which we treat other less, quote, loaded images, and more importantly, if we could trust our audience, and by this I mean the real audience, not that very small mass, a coagulated mass of tastemakers who install themselves at the doors of the public psyche, regulating the flow of the right and proper. If we could trust our real audience, and not only trust, but entrust them somehow with our work around sexuality, we could begin to enter the discussion in a positive sense and claim as much right to represent our sexuality, sometimes explicitly, as does the entertainment and pornography industry right now. But before I begin to assume a truly crusading role, an advocate of doing it in public somehow, which takes on an ironic cast today, I will return to my original premise. Why, as a woman, it seems important to begin to produce imagery which is at times sexually explicit. It is, in fact, based in the critique, which I share, of the mass sex media's construction of my private life through mass-circulated images of a false and damaged female sexuality. It is to this that I object most strongly. And just as I feel authorized to interact with an audience on my own terms around issues of family violence, working conditions, abortion rights, and so on, which are also part of my private life, I have begun to feel authorized to interact with an audience around issues of sexual representation, because all of these issues also exist within a public and social realm, and the clear delineation of how the one constructs the other, the social constructing the private, is one of the most important aspects which we as artists can discuss with our audience. To conclude, I would say that an easing of our erotophobia toward our real and genuinely participating audience is necessary, for the reasons I have said previously and for one final reason. Because our erotophobia may be truly located in not just a fear of the erotic on our own part, but in a fear of arousal of others. And by this, I of course mean men. And this is the most difficult part, because as women, we have been made aware from childhood as a kind of intuition become knowledge through direct or indirect information, which of this danger, which is our social heritage as females. And it's this danger, physical dangers are present in male arousal. But if we are to relinquish our status as victim, we have to locate at least some of our power in our sexuality and represent it from our own point of view. That was that paper. Now, I wrote that in 1984. And I had, Kim Tomczak and I had produced the videotape and the performance at that point. And we were, I think the magazine, the Insight magazine article was out. I'm going to show you now 30 slides, which are from my earlier work. As I said, I refer to this as a polemic, and it definitely was. I did it to stir up a little controversy and be a little bit bratty and show Mary Kelly a thing or two and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. The truth was is that up until, like, the last 12 months before this, I had produced almost no explicitly sexual imagery. I produced things which I'm going to show you, which are, they're old, they're primarily from the period of time when I was in the early 70s, before I began to do videotapes, when I was doing photographs. And, you know, they're very shy, somewhat. But I'd like to share them with you and tell you somewhat of what all of the material that I'm showing you specifically things not from notebooks, in a sense. With the exception of the first photograph, everything I'm showing you has been exhibited at least once publicly. And I'll tell you about the conditions under which it was exhibited. Oh, yeah, I know. Sorry. Okay. Wait. Stop. Hold on. Maybe you could, is the first slide in? Do you know? It's not. That's okay. You can turn the lights off then. That's fine. Just leave the first slide out. Don't put it up yet. And the lights could go off and they can stay off. Thanks. Can you just leave it? Okay. What's going on here? This part of the reason about a week before I came to this conference, I decided to to show these slides, and consequently I had to take them then, so they're sort of terrible. But I decided to make this particular kind of presentation, which was a personal history, which I've never done before. This was occasioned by me opening up the conference materials a week ago, and discovering that my name was not on this. Can you take that slide off? Get it off. Thank you. That's okay. Discovering that my name was not included in this panel. And I really, it was a printing error. It was an error that was made. It wasn't intentional. But I had such a deep feeling of loss at the possibility of not speaking on this panel that I was catapulted into this incredible emotional state that I shook for an hour. And I realized that I probably did have something to say on the subject. So, that was not polemical, as this paper was, and was not theoretical, and was not the kinds of things which I have, the particular kinds of presentations that I have made over the past couple of years around art issues, and that indeed might be personal. I also, part of the feelings that I had were around this, the idea of this conference coming together, and it was a real unknown to me. And also that we were going to be doing the performance, which most of you have seen. And I have been to and attended and delivered papers at 4 sex conferences in the last 12 months. And I have a feeling they're coming to an end. And I know that my work around sexuality, even as unformed as some of this early stuff is not coming to an end. So I wanted to in a sense, address, I really did want to say that there's a kind of I think there's some, there's a lot of progress that has been made this weekend in terms of just certain types of discussions. As an artist who has produced imagery fairly consistently, explicit or not explicit, over the last 14 years, I have a fear of the trendiness of the issues around sexuality. And I think that people who are in positions to do certain things, such as academics, people working in community work, other artists, people in cultural positions, I think I have something to say to all of those people around how, around certain kinds of things that I have experienced with my work. I've never had an opportunity to discuss the sexuality in my work before today. So, with that introduction, I will show you the first slide, which is the only slide that is not a photograph of my own work. This is a slide taken in 1970 by an amateur photographer named Taco Nasitu. He was a photography student at Ryerson Polytechnic in Toronto. This may need focusing, I think I noticed. Maybe it's not even there at all. No, it's gone. There it is. Can you focus that? That's a photograph of me. And I was an artist model, made my living, my full living for 5 years as a I was painted and photographed by a wide range of individuals in and around Kansas City, Missouri, where I lived before I came to Canada, and Toronto since then. So that's what I did with my time to make my living. Things changed quite drastically for me in 1971. And I showed you that slide to illustrate to you that when something which I don't think I've ever said before, but I incorporated nudity, frontal nudity or noodle frontity, whichever you want to call it, in my work, both for myself and for other people involved in it from the beginning, and it wasn't anything because I'd already made my living doing it for 5 years. I'd taken off my clothes in public. And that particular prohibition and taboo was simply not there for me. Other issues were, but that one wasn't. So the nudity in and of itself was not an issue. I thought I got educated on that. In 1971, I was not taking any photographs or doing any kind of artwork, and I began to do photography in the basement and didn't show it to anyone, ever. And I joined, because a friend of mine suggested that I join it, the Baldwin Street Women's Photography Co-op, which is a group of 13 women. We showed each other our own work, and we curated a large show, an exhibition we got photographs from right across the country, and we curated an exhibition of about, I think, 75 or 80 photographs, which we then traveled across the country and exhibited and talked to other women's groups. And that was my first experience with a collective and with a women's group in a cultural sense rather than a political sense. I'd been in women's groups politically before that. But that was a turning point for me. I still didn't call myself a photographer or an artist. That took me about 5 years to do. I didn't call myself a photographer because I felt I didn't have the technical ability to call myself a photographer. And I didn't call myself an artist because I hadn't gone to art school. So those are my reasons. I'm going to show you some early work, which all of it's early work, why did I say that? This was exhibited in A Space in 1973. It was a two-woman show. I had about 30 photographs in it, and the other woman had about 15. She was the woman who brought me into the photo co-op. We created, I think in the spirit of the time, we created a sitting room in the gallery. We had quilts and curtains and candy and